Sometimes I don't know how I'm gonna do it. Ahead there's a storm, I don't see a way through it. But I still believe that this too shall pass. If there's a ceiling, I'm breaking the glass. If there's a ceiling, I'm breaking the glass.
Hello and welcome back. This is episode number 2. And at the time of recording, it's the second week of January 2025. Now, we've seen some sub-zero temperatures, so I hope you're managing to keep warm and you're not one of those that's relied too much on the £300 winter heating allowance, know what I mean? Which reminds me of my childhood when we didn't have central heating all throughout the house, as we do now. We had an open fire in the living room with a back boiler. That was a thick metal box that was built into the chimney, and when the fire was lit, it used to heat the hot water. Oh, this was long before duvets. I mean, beds had cold cotton sheets, heavy blankets, and a candlewick bedspread, if you were lucky. Waking up in the morning with a freezing cold nose and ears, it was a well-timed manoeuvre to jump out of bed, whip off your thick pyjama top, and quickly get dressed. You've got your vest, your shirt and your jumper. Kids today, I mean, they don't know they're born. Even as a small child, I would be expected to go and get some coal from the cellar or chop kindling. You kept warm by doing things. It was a very different time. Maybe because we had chores to do or weren't wrapped up in cotton wool as kids are these days, we became more mature from an early age. I can remember being handed a small axe. It was the size of a hammer, and I still remember the health and safety training that my mum gave me. Here, make yourself useful, chop some kindling, but be careful. I haven't got time to be running you to hospital. That was it. Be careful. The blanket warning to cover all circumstances. Go and get the fire started in the room, but be careful. Sheets of newspaper screwed up into balls, not too tight or they won't burn properly. Little sticks of kindling stacked like a Red Indian's teepee and then lit with a match, or sometimes there were these long thin candles, or what Mum called a taper, which was strips of paper that had been twisted to burn slowly whilst you lit different sides of the fire. Well, can you imagine getting a kid to do that these days? Although, it was around that time that I did get electrocuted. We were living in town in a brick-built terraced house, but we hadn't yet got all mod cons, as they used to say. The toilet was in the backyard. I've got this funny memory of being a small boy sitting on a cold toilet seat out in the back garden, having to shout to Mum, "I'm ready," so that Mum could bring the loo roll out. You see, you couldn't leave the toilet roll out there because it got too damp to be able to use. Anyway, at the front of the house, just off the pavement, was a wooden hatch. And the coalman would pull up in his flatbed truck and he would open that hatch and then carry a heavy Hessian sack on his shoulder and tip one or two of them down a chute into the coal cellar and then close the hatch again. Sometimes Mum would tell me to take the plastic bucket, because it was easier to carry, downstairs to the cellar and bring up a few shovels of coal. Always followed, of course, by "be careful." Well, it was a damp, dark place full of cobwebs that you accessed by walking down some well-worn wooden stairs. I wasn't scared of the dark. The idea of ghosts and monsters, well, they get put in your head by watching films, reading books or being told stories. None of that had happened by that age. The only light was from a low-powered single light bulb hanging from the ceiling. To turn that dimly lit bulb on, you needed to flick the switch on the wall. Now the switch, quite normal for that time, was a circular brown Bakelite switch. Bakelite, for those of you that don't know, was an early form of plastic. It was used in everything from electrical switches to telephones to washing machine parts. It was a strong kind of material, but hit hard enough, well, it smashed like an eggshell. Well, I guess our switch had suffered some sort of impact because half of the front cover was missing, exposing the live electrics beneath it. And as I reached up, being only 5 years old, standing on that damp stone floor in the dark cellar, my finger missed the switch and made contact with the dangerous metal connectors. I didn't just feel it then. For the next 40 years of my life, if I thought about it, I could still feel that electricity going down my arm. I could taste that weird taste in my mouth and still hear that buzzing in my head. Maybe that's why my brain works the way it does. Electric shock therapy. Imagine having your arm shaken violently so fast that it vibrated the whole of your body. I mean, it should have killed me. I'm not sure what set of circumstances came together to save me. Maybe there was something on the floor and I was standing on it, just insulating me enough to protect me. I don't know. Yes, I still got my 3 shovels of coal into the bucket before going back upstairs, and Mum put some ointment on my fingers. Germaline, I should imagine. She used that for everything. It was pink and had a funny smell, as I remember correctly. Anyway, I didn't die, obviously, and they had the switch changed, so it wasn't a problem anymore. So, I hope you're keeping warm, and I'm going to try really hard not to talk about politics on this podcast, because I believe, well, everyone's entitled to their opinion. Growing up, we didn't talk about politics or religion, and my dad wasn't into football, nor was I. So that's another subject not discussed. In fact, we didn't talk about much really, except for something called old tin pots. Mum used to say to me, "Johnny, tell me one of your old tin pots." I mean, is that even a thing? Did other people ever say that? Mum, Nan and Grandad came from the East End of London, Bethnal Green, Alf Garnett territory. I mean, was it an East End thing? I honestly don't know. I know the term tin pot refers to something of little value, like tin pot republics and a tin pot general who's covered in medals given to them to look good, but they've not actually done anything to earn them. So I'd tell her an old tin pot while she did her housework. I'd tell her about the time I was in the jungle and went hunting with a bow and arrow made from a tree branch and an old snake. Or when I was a cowboy in the Wild West and they made me sheriff because I'd fought all those Indians with a catapult. They weren't lies, they were just stories to pass the time. And it trained me to use my imagination. It's something more parents should do, as long as they make it clear that being creative is one thing, but lying is another. I read something once that said, if you don't tell lies, you don't need such a good memory. And I guess that's true. So today I'm going to start by talking about how and why I became a hypnotherapist. And being creative and able to tell stories is a great tool for a hypnotherapist. If you listened to episode 1, you'll remember some of my life events. I was in the building trade. I worked as an IT instructor, a driving instructor, and on the subject of health, I had bowel cancer. Well, all of those became connected. So let's start with building and then IT, computers if you like. IT stands for information technology, and it wasn't around when I left school in 1976. The most technical thing we had was the pocket calculator. And apart from using it for maths, the cleverest thing anyone did with it was type the numbers 710-77345. Because on a digital display, if you turn it upside down, it spells out the word Shell Oil. Not really that technical, is it? the desktop computer, that was a thing of the 80s and 90s, but during that period I was working as a bricklayer, so I missed out on those. Then I set up my own small building company. I did things like repointing chimneys and bricking up doors and building garden walls and small conservatories. Back then, tradesmen, such as myself, would go to the local printer and you'd have A4 sheets of letterheaded notepaper printed along with your business cards, and then you'd use a typewriter to type out your quotes and your invoices, mostly typed with just one finger. Well, then came the housing market crash of the early 1990s, and there just wasn't enough work for us brickies, so I ended up working in a factory for a couple of years. And I can tell you, I hated every single minute of it. But I had a young family and we needed the wages. But there was one incident, however, that changed everything. I was on the night shift working from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. We used to do 12-hour shifts. But the factory had run out of materials. So the day shift had spent 12 hours walking around with brooms and hose pipes, washing down the machines. It was a dog food factory. We turned up and then washed down the same things that had already been cleaned for the last 12 hours by the previous lot. Total waste of time. My wife was 9 months pregnant and she'd had an abscess under a tooth. Now, she couldn't take any painkillers because of the baby, and she hadn't slept all night, and she was climbing the walls, as they say. Around 3 a.m. she phoned the factory and asked me if I could leave her and come home. There wasn't really anything that I could do, but you know what, when you're in such pain, just having someone to give you a cuddle and make you a hot drink or whatever, it really helps. And I said, yeah, no problem. Look, we aren't doing anything anyway. So I went to the shift manager and I explained and I asked, can I go? I know I won't get paid, but we aren't doing anything. And I clock off at 6 in 3 hours' time. Yes, he said, you can go, but just don't bother coming back. If I let everybody go home every time their wives phoned, the factory would be in a mess. But we aren't doing anything, I said. I don't care, he replied. It's your choice. Now, I'll tell you, I was all ready to walk out. But I phoned my wife to tell her I was coming home, and she said, no, look, stay there, we really need that money. So I stayed on, but it really bugged me. And a few weeks later, and for no actual reason on that day, I remember I was just walking from one part of the factory to the other, and I just stopped. And I said, oh, sod it. And I walked out. I didn't even have another job to go to. So I went straight to the job centre. Now, I thought you'd just walk in, be given another job and go and start somewhere else. But full-time jobs were scarce and I didn't have the right qualifications for a lot of them. Actually, I didn't have any qualifications from school. And I only had my City and Guilds as a chef from college, and the pay for that was terrible. I had a young family to consider, but as I'd walked out of a job, I couldn't even claim benefits for 6 weeks. Now, my fairy godmother appeared in the form of Sandra from the job centre. She said that I'd have to wait 6 weeks to get any money unless I went on one of their approved courses. But I'd have to be unemployed for 6 months before I was allowed to go on a course. And then with a smile, she said, unless, of course, you've got some sort of injury, then you could start straight away. That's a shame, I said, but I haven't. There's no medical required, she said. If I put on this form, you've got some sort of injury, I can help you. Yeah, but I haven't, I replied, just being honest. Are you sure you don't have a back problem, she said. indicating a box on her form. Oh, yes. I said, oh, yes, my back problem from being a bricklayer, I lied. And with a grin, she ticked the box and I was booked onto a course. It was local. I was going to get paid benefit money plus travel allowance and I would learn to use a computer. Well, I knew nothing about computers, but the keyboard was the same as a typewriter, so that was a start. They put me on the NVQ Level 1 course, and we were all just learning from an old textbook. We had to choose an option from a list, so I chose helping other users. Now, this course, it was for adults to learn how to use computers to get back to work. And people started at different times to each other. There wasn't a set start and finish. You just had to complete a number of tasks and fill in a progress book as you went along, which was then verified by an examiner to ensure that you actually understood the subject. And some people were just quicker than others. Now, for some reason, it just clicked with me. Not only that, but the people that I had helped were getting through the course quicker than others. Then I was asked to go to the office and see the centre manager. And they offered me a job as part-time instructor. Right, typically, whatever I got paid was deducted from my benefits, so I was no better off financially, but I still took the job. It felt better to be earning than just taking, and I thought it would look good on a CV. Then, a few weeks later, after doing that job, they asked me to go back upstairs to see the manager again. Oh, well, that was short-lived, I thought, but no. They said the senior instructor was leaving and they asked if I wanted to take over. Apparently, the exam board had written to the company saying that since I had been teaching, people were getting through the course quicker and they understood a lot more. So I took the job. Now, on paper, it sounded great. Senior IT instructor, centre coordinator between the company and the London Chamber of Commerce Examinations Board, internal verifier, which meant I checked the workbooks and advised people what work they needed to do to comply with different things. And the money was so poor that I had to claim family credit to keep paying my bills. Not the big money in computers that I'd heard about. The trouble was this was training unemployed people on government contracts. So I started to look for a way to top up my wages. Now, I'd heard that big companies would upgrade all of their equipment quite often. That was normal back then. Computers advanced a lot in the early days. And when they did, all of their old equipment was sent to a specialist auction. So I decided to go along and have a look. In fact, I remember the auction. It was down in Witham in Essex. And that was that. I got some money together and I bought a pallet of old computers. I took them home, fixed what needed fixing, and then gave them a good clean. Then I advertised them in school magazines and places like that. And I would deliver a system. I'd set it up and I'd give the customers like a lesson on the basics, you know, how to use the word processor and the paint program so you can draw a picture and databases and things like that. Sometimes when I was checking the computers, I'd find an old disc that had been left in a drive. Now, one of those discs that I found was titled 50 Greatest Books, and it had all sorts of things like poems and recipes. Shakespeare had first aid, and it had a thing on hypnosis. And I read it. And I read it again. I wasn't sure if it was real or not, but there was a section about nerves and confidence, and it was called conversational hypnosis. Now, it was around that time that things between my dad and myself had improved after my daughter was born. He was a driving instructor and he told me that learner drivers would drive perfectly fine on lessons, but then come the day of the driving test, they'd do stupid stuff they didn't normally do, all because of their nerves. If only they could avoid having those nerves, they'd be fine. So I told him about the things in the book, and I asked him what he thought, and he just laughed, and he said, "It's rubbish." He said, "It's all made up." So I didn't ask him again. A few years later, and Dad was doing a driving lesson, it was winter time, and he slipped over on an icy road. He hit his head on the curbstone and ended up with quite a bad concussion. So I was asked, could I help out for a few weeks? So I got myself qualified, and what was meant to be a few weeks, well, that ended up being 12 years in total. Because when he was no longer needed me, we had a talk about it, and then I set up my own driving school. And that's when I started to use some of those techniques that I'd learned, and they did work. Not quite the way it said in the book, no swinging watch on a chain or spinning lights, but just talking in a certain manner, carefully picking the right words and relating things back to something else they'd achieved in the past. As I say, it worked. And just when things were going really well, I started to have some toilet troubles. The first thing I remember is feeling that I needed to go for a poo several times a day, but not much happened. I did wonder whether to talk about this on the podcast. I know some people don't want to hear it, but you know, I thought, if just one person hears this and takes some action rather than ignoring the symptoms, it will actually save their life. So I will talk about it. There was a young woman, sort of a friend, if you like, and I know that she contracted bowel cancer, and she was too embarrassed to go to the doctor about it. So she didn't, and she died. Left her husband and kids. So I think it's important to talk about. But I'll be as non-graphic as I can. I sat on the loo about 5 or 6 times a day, and every now and then there'd be a bit of blood in the bowl before I flushed it. Now, like an idiot, I kept saying, oh, it's just hemorrhoids or piles. You see, I've been in the building trade sitting around on concrete floors, and I've been told that that can give you piles. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But I didn't feel ill. I wasn't losing weight. So for a long time, I ignored it. Eventually, I went to see my GP, and he sent me for a scan. And soon afterwards, I was sitting in the oncology department at the Macmillan Centre. And that's when treatment started. I needed radiotherapy every day for 6 weeks. Plus various scans. One scan, a PET, I don't know what that stands for, but a PET scan, came with some really scary advice. They told me I shouldn't keep doing driving lessons because, get this, I had received such high levels of radiation that if a young girl was pregnant, and obviously she might not even know, if she was just sitting in the car next to me for an hour, the radiation leaving my body could be enough to harm her unborn baby. What? I don't know if you remember. Do you remember years ago there was an advert on television for a breakfast cereal called Ready Breck? It was like instant porridge. Anyway, in this advert, this young boy ate his Ready Breck and then he walks to school on a winter's morning, glowing orange as he walked along. Well, that's what I imagined I must have looked like. So I shut down my business. In fairness, I couldn't work for a long time after surgery. Plus, I had trouble with the colostomy bag, so I just sat at home, bored. And I really wanted, you know, something to do, so I started reading my books again, including hypnosis. You see, a little thing happened. When I was having my radiotherapy, we used to have to sit in a waiting room for quite a long time, and I was in the waiting room one day and I heard them talking, the nurses talking to this old guy He was one of those in one of those cubicles, but you know, they just pull a curtain across. Gives you privacy that way, but you can still hear them talking. And there was one particular thing that's always stayed with me. I heard the nurse say to him, "Look, Bill, we know this is only going to give you a few more months, but it's worth just sticking with it. I know it's awkward." And then after a while, I heard him say, "Why the hell did I keep on smoking? I'd quit once. What an idiot I've been." You know, that stuck with me. I'm an ex-smoker myself. I stopped when my first daughter was born. Anyway, so I was at home reading my books, and then the idea popped into my head. Since this was liable to be a long recovery, and I'd already been thinking of things I could do from home to bring in a few extra quid, what if I became a hypnotherapist? You know, I could help people like that old guy, maybe to stop smoking. Then he wouldn't be in the situation that he was in. I'd also heard about something called NLP, which stands for Neuro-Linguistic Programming. Now, that still won't mean a lot to people, but basically, it's about how words control your thoughts, and your thoughts control your feelings, and it's your feelings that controls your actions. Salespeople often use it. When they're good at it, you find yourself signing up for things without really thinking about it. And I could see how it could work well if used with hypnosis. But I still wasn't sure how much of this hypnosis book was real and how much was just made up. So I found an online hypnotherapy course and I signed up for it. Unlike stage and street hypnosis, hypnotherapy made sense. It wasn't some quick hypnotic induction to make people cluck like a chicken. It was a slow, controlled method of relaxation, a bit like guided meditation. The basis was also in psychology rather than showmanship, and I was intrigued. I completed the online course, and when I was feeling a bit more mobile, I decided to go and do a couple of practical classroom courses. I remember I travelled down to London and I stayed in a really, really cheap, dodgy B&B. And I did a 2-day course on Neuro-Linguistic Programming, NLP. And it was really good. It wasn't just talking, it also involved body language and facial expressions. And I still use one bit as a party trick to do some mind reading. I mean, obviously I can't read minds, but I was taught how I can read eye movements and expressions so that you knew what someone was thinking of if you gave them a choice of three things and asked them to think of one of those three. I also got a nice certificate for my office wall. Then I did a course in smoking therapy, because there are lots of people to go to hypnotherapists to stop smoking, so that seemed like a worthwhile course to do. If you've never had anything to do with hypnosis, you probably wonder, as I did, is it real or not? All right, spoiler alert, yes it is. How do I know? Well, one of the first things, I watched a documentary on More4, which is like the online internet part of Channel 4. And there was a program and it was called Hypnosurgery. A hypnotherapist would help a patient to undergo surgery, I think that was actually for a hernia, without any conventional anaesthetic. watched over by other surgeons and medical professionals. They had TV cameras and they had a remote panel of experts in a studio, including a lot of skeptics. But when a surgeon takes a scalpel to you, there is no way you can just pretend not to feel anything, not when he starts cutting. You either have feeling in your body or you don't. And I know from my own very painful experience, when I had my first operation for bowel cancer, I was cut down my stomach around 14 inches. Before I went into theatre though, they gave me an epidural. And I remember they really struggled to get the needle in on my right side. I've got some very strong back muscles from years of doing judo. Anyway, I went to sleep before the operation, had the operation, and then as I began to wake up, the epidural hadn't worked on one side of my body. I had the worst pain I've ever experienced. You know, I always think of myself as a typical tough guy, I suppose, but I don't mind telling you, I screamed like a baby, like never before. Thankfully, they'd got another line going into me, and the anaesthetist put me out straight away. The second time I woke up, they'd got it sorted, thankfully. But I know 100% you can't fake that sort of pain relief. Something genuine was going on, and I wanted to know how it was done. And that's why I did those courses. I did the online course, which covered the history of hypnosis and some of the established techniques for inducing the hypnotic state in someone. There was the Dave Elman induction or the Ericksonian methods. I studied psychology, talking about Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung and other notable experts. I did the neuro-linguistic programming course to learn how our brains process information. And I did the anti-smoking course, just for the certificate, if I'm being honest. Which, as it happened, is slightly unfair, because it was on that smoking therapy day that I first actually hypnotised someone. A couple of people, actually. It turned out to be a very valuable experience for two reasons. Firstly, I got my smoking cessation certificate and was registered on a national database, which in turn earned me a fair bit of money. Plus, I gained the experience that I wanted. I found out that there were people who had spent thousands of pounds and done lots of training, yet they couldn't hypnotise anyone. And I wondered why. Was it the training or was it them? I don't know if you've ever heard the term imposter syndrome. But it's when you're doing something and other people are looking at you as an expert, yet you yourself feel like a fraud. You feel like you haven't got enough experience or you haven't achieved enough success to be regarded that way. Well, I felt like that twice. Once on a smoking therapy course, and then again when I booked myself on a course with a stage hypnotist. He was apparently a well-known stage hypnotist. He'd been featured in newspapers and magazines, but he and I we did not get on. Oh, and no, it wasn't Paul McKenna. Okay, not Paul McKenna. Anyway, at the smoking therapy day, I was chatting with others and I heard about the various courses that they'd done. There was a name that got mentioned several times for a training company, but I'd never heard of them. I was told they charged over £2,000 and some of those there had been training for a couple of years. So I asked the obvious question, oh, are you working as a hypnotherapist now? And in slight embarrassment, they admitted that they didn't feel ready yet. What? After paying £2,000 and 2 years of your life? Well, then they asked me and I told the truth, no. I wasn't working yet, but I intended to start within a couple of weeks, hence my attendance on the course. As I said, a lot of people go to hypnotherapists to stop smoking, so it made sense to do that course first. And then it happened. we were working in small groups of threes and fours, practicing what we'd been taught, and it was obvious that my study mates were not confident. They all admitted that none of them had ever actually hypnotized anyone. They knew the theory and could recite information from their various courses, but that was it, theory only. So I was asked to have a go at hypnotizing one of the ladies. And I did it. I just improvised rather than reading the script that we'd all been given. I used some of that NLP training that I'd recently done, and it worked. And my newfound friends were impressed. Do me, do me. So I did a chap in his 50s. Same result. And a couple of people in the next group to us saw what I was doing, and during lunch break, several people came to me to ask for advice. And I tried to stay humble, honestly I did, but I was also quite excited with my success. The lady running the course then asked me, in front of the others, what I thought was behind my natural ability. I'm not sure if she was asking me a genuine question or if she was being slightly defensive as the course instructor. But her question was subtle enough to help me check my ego, shall we say. And my answer seemed to be well received. I took just a moment, then I answered and I said something along the lines of, well, I think that when we're helping clients to go into that hypnotic state, it's important that we ourselves sound confident but relaxed. We need to slowly change the cadence or speed of speech to create that relaxed state. It's not just what we say, it's how we say it. I then explained that I had just been doing what I was taught on the NLP course. They called it pacing. I also explained that I was a driving instructor that spent hours every day talking to people and keeping them calm as they learned new things. So that had been a big advantage. It meant I'd become practiced in talking and explaining things at length. Most people, if they aren't used to doing it, sort of dry up after a minute or so of talking, unless the other person is responding and talking back. And I think by explaining those things rather than pretending to be some gifted master of hypnosis, a few of those barriers came down. And then there was this stage hypnotist. I won't name him. He was advertising his stage hypnosis course on the internet. As I said, it wasn't Paul McKenna, although I do have a feather in my cap associated with him. I once had a lady come to me to stop smoking, and I always used to ask clients if they've done hypnotherapy before. Several times I've had people say, yes, I've tried before, but it didn't work, so I thought I'd give you a try. Well, that's fine by me. I would say in 90% of those reactions afterwards, people would say, wow, that was brilliant, so different to the other person, it really worked. And one of those that came to me had previously tried with Mr. McKenna himself. Now, I'm sure he's great at his job, but it's just a fact of life that not every session works for various reasons, including mine. But nonetheless, she had tried with him, and it was me that actually helped her quit. Anyway, back to this other guy. So I had studied my online courses. I'd done the NLP course. I'd done my smoking cessation course and had some success with some willing victims. And yet I still had this question mark in my head. Was it real, or were people just being compliant and playing along? Yes, I'd seen the hypnosurgery program and I'd read about hypnobirthing. I'd also read that the NHS has a hypnotherapy program. It's called the Christie program. So that gave me more confidence, but I wanted to know if stage hypnosis and street hypnosis was also real, or was that just con men using stooges? So I figured the best way to find out was to go to an expert, try it for myself, and actually feel what it was like to be put under. I thought, if I was properly hypnotized myself and experienced what it felt like to be put under or induced into the hypnotic state, it would help me to know what my clients were feeling as I did it to them. Now, bear in mind, I was paying this guy, and it wasn't cheap, so I felt within my rights to ask a few questions. He didn't feel the same way. I did my best to be as non-confrontational as possible, and more, you know, inquisitive, if you know what I mean. He also made it very clear to all assembled that, in his opinion, hypnotherapists were below standard hypnotists. He said, when you can put somebody in deep hypnosis in a matter of seconds, taking 10 minutes relaxing them was pathetic, his words. So I deliberately didn't mention my plans to do hypnotherapy. Instead, I just tried to blend in with the others that were there for various reasons. There was a guy there apparently as a comedian. He wanted to add it to his act at holiday parks like Butlins and theatres. There was also a magician of sorts. I think he was one of those that did what you call corporate gigs. That's when a big business puts on an evening event for the more executive employees, and they all get dressed up in their dinner jackets and bow ties and have a fancy meal and entertainment. And sometimes they employ a magician to wander from table to table doing close-up magic, like the trick he showed me where a coin seems to disappear and then moments later it's back. He showed me that one. Anyway, so this hypnotist, he had an assistant. Well, if I wasn't already suspicious, I was now. Why would he need an assistant? There was also something else to mention. This assistant was a big fella. Maybe late 20s, early 30s, muscly. We were told he was really into his martial arts. The reason apparently for telling us this was because he had learned to focus his mind using hypnosis and often went with Mr. Expert when he did his public performances. I'm pretty sure he was there as a minder, because this hypnotist was a rude, arrogant, quite abrasive character. And I can imagine him talking his way into trouble with the wrong person. So I wasn't particularly impressed when, with a hand on his shoulder and a command, sleep, this assistant did exactly what he was told to do. A stooge, in my opinion. Nonetheless, we paired up with others in the room and practiced a couple of these different techniques. We were told not to worry if it didn't quite work, because it was the technique that we had to learn. Its effective use would come later. That said, it would appear that several of my fellow trainees were having success. We were taught to remove the number 4 from their minds as if it never existed. And you can hear people counting out 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, or counting their own fingers. They knew they had 10 digits, but then they were baffled when they kept coming up with 9. I've seen the TV personality and mentalist Darren Brown do something similar. But to suggest that Beryl from Wolverhampton can achieve the same feat in just a few minutes, well, that was beyond reasonable belief. No one was able to cause that change in me, and I really tried. I wanted to experience it for myself. Then the hypnotist guy, well, he became aware of me. Oh, if people are being deliberately resistant, it's not going to work, he said, looking straight at me. I was now the focus of everyone's attention, and it was uncomfortable. So he got me to stand in front of him. He explained he would stare into my eyes, take my hands as if we were shaking hands, whilst placing his other hand on my right shoulder, and then at the right moment say, sleep, while simultaneously tugging my hand downward slightly, adding pressure to my shoulder. This would, he declared, send me into an immediate state of hypnosis. I could feel his attempt to intimidate me, Yes, he stared into my eyes, the look of someone trying to dominate another person. And sleep, as he tugged my arm down. Just for a moment, my eyes closed and I remained very slightly bowed. But I knew I was doing it, not him. He started to explain how this rapid induction could be used with complete strangers as I straightened up and opened my eyes. I'm sorry, I said, making myself sound a little bit embarrassed, but I wasn't. I'm really not trying to resist. Well, whether you are or you're not, that's what you're doing. Right, he said, it's lunchtime anyway. There was this low mumble as we made our way over to a table which had plates of sandwiches and other buffet items on it. The comedian chappy stood next to me and in a low tone he said, well, that was a bit effing awkward, wasn't it? I don't think you made a friend there. What are you going to do? I said, what do you mean? Well, I don't know. He said, if it was me, he said, I'd be tempted to bugger off home. Huh, I've bloody paid him money to be here, I said. I came here to experience things. I don't care what he says. I wasn't trying to resist. So no, I'm staying. The afternoon session started and I stood at the back listening and watching. Around 3 o'clock we had a coffee break and I put my big boy pants on, as they say, and I went over to talk to him. Look, Bill, we'll call him Bill, but it wasn't his real name. I said, look, I'm sorry, I wasn't trying to resist. I drove a couple of hours and paid for your course because I wanted to learn. It just didn't happen. He seemed to accept what he took as an apology. I think it satisfied his ego. Well, it's not 100% every time, he said. So, although I only tried on 3 people, it seemed to work on all of them. And none of them made it work with me. I asked the ones that had been my subjects, tell me honestly, how much of that was just you helping things? And only one admitted that he wasn't fully hypnotised, but even he said it was like you weren't unaware of what you were doing, but it felt like it was your choice and you wanted to do it. So, after wasting a whole day having a 4-hour round trip, which cost money for fuel, and spending a little over £100, I was none the wiser. I still hadn't experienced it myself. A couple of weeks later, my daughter told me about someone that she knew. He did stage hypnosis, but at a more local, small venue sort of level. He's a young fella. And he agreed for a small fee to meet me in a local Wetherspoons and do some one-on-one training with me. Now, this time I had a different plan. I was going to play along and then see if he gave the game away because he would know it was fake. Well, he brought a friend with him, yet another stooge, who played along even when I did the induction. The manager at the Wetherspoons came over and after a while and he asked us to stop what we're doing, as a couple of patrons had complained they were a bit iffy about what we were doing. And that was it. When I did my very first online course, it said that stage hypnosis was mostly fake. They said the majority of people that get up on stage are the same sort of people that get up and do karaoke in a pub. They like to be centre of attention. And with a hypnotist's act, they can be even more dramatic and then blame it on being hypnotised. Although there are some people by nature who are highly suggestible. So I guess by now you're as completely confused as I was. But what I can tell you is hypnotherapy is different. Back then, when I was a full-time hypnotherapist, working from home and from a complementary health clinic, I was getting paid £50 an hour. No audience, just me and them, and people don't pay that sort of money to play along with nobody watching. I had a guy come to me once who was, he was suffering from real depression. He had already had an NHS hypnotherapy treatment course, 6 one-hour sessions with a clinical hypnotherapist in an NHS clinic, and it hadn't helped him, not a bit. He'd heard about me from someone he knew that had quit a 30-year smoking habit after just one session. I did quite a few of those. Now, I want you to think about the job description. Hypnotherapist or hypnotherapist. A therapist that uses hypnosis as a tool. Like a psychotherapist is a therapist that uses psychology. Now, I was always very clear right from the first meeting. I was not a doctor or medically trained, even though I had certificates on my wall saying clinical hypnotherapist, member of the Ethical and Professional Hypnotherapists Association, NLP practitioner, and member of the Association of Smoking Cessation Therapists. The certificates added a bit of credibility when people came in to see me, and if that helped me to help others, I was okay with that. But I was not trained in therapy. I did what I thought would work. In my head, I was like a detective, the Sherlock Holmes of hypnotherapy. I always started by just having to talk with people. I'd ask questions, ask them about their issues. Then I used to explain how hypnotherapy works, explain the stages we would go through. You see, people always come with expectations. They say they don't know anything about being hypnotized, but years of watching films and reading books or hearing stories from other people, all of that information or misinformation is buried deep inside their heads. So you need to address that first, and a lot of hypnotherapists don't. Some people, when they're in that deep hypnotic state, will be oblivious to everything around them, whilst others, and I've had this happen, some will become hypersensitive and they'll hear things that are really difficult to hear that the rest of us can't hear. For that reason, you always need to tell them that they will hear noises, but you can just ignore them. If you don't tell them, then a noisy car goes past, like that, well, then it can be enough of a distraction to break their concentration and the session. Anyway, back to my chat with depression. After working for years in a job that he loved with a small group of workmates in a little workshop where his dad had previously worked, they had a new manager come in and he completely changed everything. They all complained, but my chap really got into an argument with him and he ended up losing his job. He was quite disappointed that none of his workmates had backed him up, and I think that added to his problems. Bear in mind, the NHS hypnotherapist had been ineffective, and it was not just affecting him, but his family too. His wife was really worried about him, so imagine the sense of relief and satisfaction when around a week after his session there was a knock at my door. And there he stood, a warm, happy smile on his face, as did his wife that had come with him. I invited them in and they just couldn't thank me enough. She said the transformation was like night and day. He was back to being the positive, happy husband and father that he'd previously been. And they handed me a thank you card and a little box of chocolates. Yes, I've been paid for my services and now I've got a lovely extra show of appreciation. But honestly, it was the sheer satisfaction of knowing I've been able to help someone going through a dark time and his family that really made it all worthwhile. Some things are worth more than money. Now then, I did say that during this episode, I'd give you all a little present. A couple of simple techniques that anyone can use to help them relax, de-stress and get a better night's sleep. A lot of what I do comes from my own mind, but if I say something and you see or hear it somewhere else, it doesn't matter. Hypnosis is an often misunderstood craft. Without going into the history, the term hypnosis, taken from the Greek hypnos, the god of sleep, probably wasn't the most helpful of descriptions. Whenever I sit with a client for the first time, we always start with me explaining what it is and how it works, and I usually relate it to watching something on television. Have you ever been watching a TV program and got so engrossed in it, concentrated so much, that someone's spoken to you but you didn't really hear them? Or other people can be chatting but you completely ignore them? Well, that's not sleep, is it? In fact, it's the complete opposite. You're in a state of intense focus. And that's hypnosis. And the role of the hypnotherapist is to guide and direct that focus. We are the storytellers, the creators of the pictures in your mind. You may wonder, as some people have asked, can you get stuck in hypnosis? Or, well, I love this one, what would happen if halfway through the process the hypnotherapist dropped down dead? All right, fair question. Well, no, you can't get stuck. If you fell asleep during the process, and I've had a couple of clients that have just done just that, you could either just sleep and then wake up as normal, or your hypnotherapist could wake you up verbally or with a little gentle tap on the hand. And the same answer if the hypnotherapist just stopped for whatever reason. Your mind would take over and you would either wake up again or continue into normal sleep. So it is perfectly safe. So the two methods, both are guided relaxation techniques, and we're going to call them the feather and the sea. The art of the hypnotherapist is to be as descriptive as possible. If you close your eyes and listen to my words, then as long as you understand what I'm saying, your own mind will create those images for you. Now, a word of warning here. If you're driving or doing anything that needs concentration, please stop this recording. Listen to it at a more convenient time. It seriously could be dangerous if you didn't. To help you sleep or just relax, I'd like you to get as comfortable as you can. Avoid distractions, so put your phone on silent, and it doesn't need to be complete silence. In fact, some low-level background noise is good. Settle back and close your eyes. And in your mind, I want you to imagine a room that is quite dark, with walls of soft black velvet. And in the centre of the room floats a beautiful white feather. Look how it curves gently and watch it as it gently drifts downwards. It doesn't fall straight, instead it sways gently from side to side, creating small arcs as it drifts down deeper and deeper, side to side. Notice the little strands of downy feather on the edges as the warm air passes gently through them. The feather drifting slowly and easily towards the floor. Just before it lands, a warm air current lifts it up again, swirling gently in the dark, peaceful room. No noises, no interruptions, just peace and tranquility as the feather drifts again, deeper and deeper. And as it does, allow yourself also to drift down, deeper and deeper, into a wonderful feeling of relaxation. And you can imagine all of the stresses just disappearing as you move into that wonderful feeling of peaceful, relaxed sleep. Okay, so the next technique works by focusing on your breathing. It's control of both body and mind, but more than that, it sends a message to your subconscious. You see, the subconscious believes what it what you tell it, if told convincingly enough anyway. Your conscious mind, on the other hand, well, that knows the truth, but the subconscious, that believes what it's told, no matter how real that message is. You know, here in the UK, house spiders can't hurt us. We know that in our conscious, logical mind. I mean, look at the size of them from leg to leg. And then their body in the middle is the size of, say, I don't know, a sultana. Their head, well, what's that? The size of a match head. Their mouth, well, that's the size of a pencil dot on a piece of paper. There is just no way they can hurt us. And yet, people can be terrified. Why? Because that feeling comes from the illogical subconscious mind. So we can use that to our advantage. We can send a message to the subconscious and tell it that as we breathe in and out, we can control the waves of the sea. We breathe in, the waves roll out, and we breathe out, and the waves roll in. Again, settle back, close your eyes. I want you to imagine laying on a beautiful sun-kissed beach, somewhere exotic like the Bahamas, and it's a private, secure beach. In the distance, you can just hear the sound of children playing happily as you lay on that warm, silvery sand that runs through your fingers like fine grains of salt. And you become aware of the sound of the sea, the waves as they roll in onto the beach, the water turning to soft white foam, then being drawn back out again. You notice the sound of your breathing. Listen as you breathe in through your nose and then out through your mouth. Breathe in and watch in your mind as the wave is pulled out. You can hear the tiny stones being pulled out. And then just for a moment, silence. Before you breathe out, and the waves roll back in again, foaming white on those soft, silvery sands. Now we repeat this process in and out, controlling the speed of our breathing to match the images in our mind. As we do, you will notice that you become more and more relaxed. You can use either of those, or you can use one then the other, the feather then the sea, to help you reach a state of gentle relaxation. And like anything new, takes a little bit of practice, but the more you do, the better and the easier it becomes. To close, I'd just like to talk about something that's become quite popular recently. Completely different subject now. Selling off secondhand clothes. Now please, don't dismiss this idea just yet. There are people earning a few hundred pounds every month. They're not even selling their own clothes. Although, if we're honest, we've all got things in our wardrobes that we no longer wear. Maybe they don't fit anymore, or you simply don't like them. But some people go to their local charity shops and they pick through the £1 rail. I saw someone do that recently. He picked up a men's Ben Sherman shirt, size 15 collar in light blue. He took it home and washed and ironed it, along with his usual laundry. Oh, another classic one is the Fred Perry t-shirts. They're also big sellers. then using the free app, that's the application that you can get, you can download it onto your phone from Vinted. And he took a couple of pictures on his phone and he listed it for sale. And it sold really quickly for £10 plus the postage. He gets the full £10. The seller pays £10 plus a small fee. I think it's just over £1, £1.30 or something, that goes to Vinted plus the postage. And they can choose whether to have standard postage or express. It's up to them. The seller uses the app to print out a label. And then they pack it and they send it off. So, yes, you need a camera phone or a laptop. You need a printer, but maybe somebody in your family has one if you haven't. But once you've got those basics, well, there's no limit. You can sell clothes for adults, for babies, shoes, handbags, and many other items. It's weird how a lot of people have got things hanging up in their wardrobes and they think they're worth nothing. It's also now free to sell on eBay. And although you can, I would avoid selling on Facebook because you don't want people coming to your home. The other great thing, of course, about selling second-hand items is, well, it's good for the environment because it's better to recycle than to send stuff that ends up in the landfill. And that's it for this episode. So I'd like you to join me next time when we take a virtual tour of Longleat Safari Park. Plus, there's going to be advice on avoiding scammers. And I'll tell you about my first aeroplane flight, which may surprise you. And we're going to look at how anyone can write a book and get it published for free. So until next time, thank you for joining me. And if you haven't already done so, go on, subscribe to this podcast and tell your friends.